Welcome, 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 welcome. We are coming to the end of a long road here, a glorious road, a memorable road. The RV is pulling into its final stop, and we're here waiting for you. That's right. It's the recap, overthinking it style, of the final episode of Breaking Bad, Season 5, Episode 16, Felina. I'm Pete Fenzel. I'll be hosting this with a mighty panel of all of our contributors through the season. Everybody here to send off the show in style and contribute some analysis and insights. Whether you're watching us live on YouTube, whether you're checking us out on a YouTube replay, listening to us on iTunes through our TV recap podcast, or whether this gets transferred over to maybe another podcast channel, reposted, wherever you find us, we hope that you're enjoying it. And
that's podcast, bitches.
Well, no, Matt, this is the one where I get to be in it. You get to be in the driver's seat in all of our other podcasts. No, but yes, we have to.
Oh, you want this? then do it yourself.
Yay!
Well, then I shall. Well, let's go through in traditional alphabetical order, and we'll say hi to all of our panelists. Ben Adams, how are you doing? How's happy end of Breaking Bad, or soulful and mournful and I don't know. How would you describe, in one word, how would you describe your feelings at the end of Breaking Bad, Ben?
Good. No, I love the ending. I thought it was great.
Oh, great. Awesome. That's wonderful. All right, now I got to do a little bit of math up in my head because I think the next person in alphabetical order is John Parrish. How are you doing?
M comes before P.
Oh, that's right. I was incorrect. I stink at letters and numbers. Shane Amlowski, how are you doing? How are you feeling at the end of Breaking Bad? Thanks. Welcome back, first of all, from your illness that kept you out of
the thank you very much. Yeah, sorry about that. I felt pretty great about Breaking Bad, I gotta say. This is probably surprising to no one, but many mollies were holied mollies. There were a lot of holy mollies is what I was going to say.
Oh, good, good, good. Because that's been our standard, of course, of excellence for
Absolutely.
The entire series, or the season at least, is the number of holy mollies that Shayna registers with. Also, Shayna, I have to say, your video reception is looking excellent today.
Thank you. Go internet.
All right, excellent. Before it starts chunking up and framing down, now we'll say hello to John Parrish. How are you doing, John? And what are you
feeling? Hello! Hey. Hello, everybody. I'm doing all right. Apologies if my voice is a little rough. I am getting over a cold or something, so tonight's recap is brought to you by the ingredient that started it all, pseudoephedrine. I am totally high on legally acquired pseudoephedrine, and I'm feeling great.
Tight! Awesome.
I thought we were switching from a pseudo-podcast to a methylamine podcast.
Look, man, you know, I don't drive trains.
If you go that way, you're going to need a bigger podcast.
Man, that joke was courtesy of Matt Rather, or at least the beginning of it, the setup, as it were. Matt Rather, how are you doing, Matt?
Out in the West Texas town of Los Angeles, I started podcasting with overthinkers.
Is that going to be the long 7-minute version for the radio, or the short, or the 5-minute version, or the short 2.5-minute version?
Blacker than night were the eyes of Malofsky. Uh-huh. Whiter than snow was Pete's coconut water.
Yay! Excellent. Of course, we're talking about the Marty Robbins song "El Paso," which is one of the major informing artistic documents of this episode. But before we get into that, Matt, how did you feel about the end of Breaking Bad?
Satisfied. Really?
Yeah.
Since The Shield. And it's because they're both anti-hero shows. I mean, for a lot of reasons, because they both just kicked ass. Like, they both just hit homer after homer in their final season. These shows have been getting compared a lot recently, at least in what I've been reading. And I mean, I don't know, The Shield sets a high bar for finale, and I mean, I'd like to talk a little bit about like last shots, about last moments in relationship to The Shield, because I think they could be in an interesting dialogue. But yeah, satisfied is my word.
You're gonna spoil The Shield for me? Oh no.
Oh, I guess.
I mean, it ended a long time ago. It's fine.
We'll talk about it. This will have spoilers for Breaking Bad, by the way. So if you're watching the episode recap of the final episode of Breaking Bad, and you're like, you spoiled it for me, you were expecting a mightier, nigh Herculean effort from us to recap the episode without spoiling it. We'll try to keep the shield. We'll make the shield analysis, and we're going to have to keep it somewhat to a minimum so as not to spoil it outright for people. But I think it invites a certain amount of comparison. So we'll tread lightly, as they say in the garage. But I actually, we'll get to that stuff, but I really wanted to start, because this is also the end of the arc of recaps that we've been doing. And through our recaps, we've kind of developed a bunch of ways of talking about this season and the uniting artistic themes or the themes in terms of, you know, the meaning and the semantics, and also in terms of the aesthetics, right? And in terms of its sort of artistic mission. What is this season about? What is it concerned with? What are the parts of it that make it successful or exciting or interesting? And one of the big ones I think that is cut across all of our episodes is what John called the false reveal, and which I'll broaden more broadly into this idea of, you know, finding things out that compel you to do stuff. And then, of course, with John's description, like, well, is the thing that you're seeing real or not? Is the power that it is a revelation diminished by the fact that it's not real or true? And I mean, John, you were pointed this out back during the episode with the money in front of the headlights. Was the first one we talked about that, or was it the rabid dog episode?
I believe so. I'd be hard pressed to say exactly when that came up. Mm-hmm. So if you're giving me the talking conch.
Mm-hmm. The talking, it's yours. Take the conch, John. Take the conch. Run with it.
I'd say we have quite a few instances of the false reveal in this episode, in that, you know, Walt shows up out of nowhere in Albuquerque and has a number of conversations with people he knew in his past life. He knew in his life a year ago, or almost a year ago. And he doesn't tell the complete truth to any of them, except at the very end. So, just briefly, and I know you guys have more on this, so I'm not going to go too deep. There's when he shows up at the Schwartz's house, at Elliot and Gretchen's house, and he gives them the money, and, you know, he presumably has an honest intention of getting that to Flynn, but there's the story he tells him about the two best hitmen, you know, west of the Mississippi, which is of course false. And you kind of see that coming, because who's he going to get in touch with? But we know that the Schwartz is dumb. There's when he appears at Lydia and Todd's table in the cafe, and he says he has this secret plan to cook methylamine or to cook meth that doesn't require methylamine, which is of course false. And then there's when he shows up at Skylar's place, and she asks him about the money, and he says, "No, I don't have any to give you. I used it all up getting here," which is true in a manner of speaking, but is still technically false. Like, he's still technically lying to her, and he has to, because if he even gave away a hint of where Flynn's future money was coming from, she wouldn't take it, neither would he, and who can blame them? The only person he's really and completely honest with, and even then it's only at the very last minute, is Jesse. And you'll note that he's the person with whom he has the least dialogue. He actually says the least to him in terms of lines on the page, words exchanged back and forth, because obviously these guys have such a history that there's very little they need to say to each other. They can communicate a lot through words and gestures and through killing or failing to kill each other.
Right. So, yeah, and so it's a series of different sorts of saying goodbye, you know, final reckonings. And I would even add one more to it. And this is the one I think that connects a lot with the visual motifs of the show, which is when he says goodbye to the vat, when he says goodbye to the lab, to chemistry, right? And I feel like when he rubs the stainless steel of the vat and you see his reflection in it, and of course it's sort of covered with his blood as he falls to the ground, I couldn't help but think of brushing off the money in front of the headlight, or even the fact that all the money is buried, right, and you have to like dig the money up. But really that idea that an old man with the money looking at it in front of the headlight of his car, and how similar it felt to Walt looking at his own reflection at the end of his life and kind of like sizing it all up and realizing what it really was. Right. Because, I mean, if this season has been about kind of series of revelations of everybody finding out stuff, and then this is the episode where Walt finds out a bunch of stuff about himself, and reveals them. If he didn't know them, certainly makes them known. If he knew them, then makes them clear, like buys into them, stops fighting them, right? His big confession to Skylar about the truth of his intentions, his happiness, right, at doing the thing that he loved to do, and dying with a smile on his face in his meth lab. I think that kind of, or a slight smile on his face, kind of measures up to all that stuff. I mean, was there any other? What do you guys think? Because there's a lot of images of Walt kind of fading away throughout this episode. Like when he's walking away from Flynn, there, and you know, he's hiding behind the window. There's a semi-opaque pane of glass that he walks that is between the camera and Walt, and you see as he goes away, his image rapidly diminish. It's like the season is showing us goodbyes to Walt in various ways, but making his image blurrier. And I mean, this is one of the other things, is that like, I guess as it fades into legend, I suppose, something along those lines.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw in past weeks, and then a lot in this episode, his reflection, whether it was in a window, in the vat, in the rearview mirror, we're seeing parts of him or blurriness. And also in this episode, like you sort of alluded to, Pete, he was looking through windows, and we were watching him watching people through windows. So everything was sort of framed. It was sort of like we're watching people almost watch TV in a way, even though obviously it's not TV in their world, but they're seeing everything through sort of like a squarish frame. And I guess they're seeing each other as TV images, as pulp images in a way, which is what we've been talking about all season. So yeah, I definitely agree with that. Good show.
Yeah. I would just say that, like, oh, well, we were on the right track for a lot of the discussions that we've been having over the course of last season about a lot of the stuff where this was going. I mean, I guess if we're talking about pulp, there's been a lot of talk about genre. I feel like a lot of the recaps I've read have kind of broken down from the usual analysis of this episode and just sort of been concerned with like the largeness of the show and the final reckoning and like, oh, this is the 700 word article where we're going to determine whether Walt was a good or bad person. Mm-hmm. Right. I find that article to be hilarious because it's like, well, we've had years to discuss that. You're not going to figure it out right now. So I feel like there's a lot in the episode to unpack. We'll get to the bigger questions in a second, or you know, in a few minutes. We have a little bit of time, but the question of genre has come up a lot. And you know, Shannon, you talked about pulp. Obviously, this episode is heavily concerned with the song "El Paso" by Marty Robbins, the character of Felina, who is the woman in the song, the Mexican woman. The song is about a gunslinger who falls in love with a Mexican woman who likes to dance in a shady bar. When another guy flirts with her, he shoots him in an impulsive moment. Then he flees away to New Mexico, but his love pulls him back. And when he gets back to El Paso, he is shot and killed and dies, either has a hallucination of Felina or actually has Felina arrive and hold him in his arms as he dies.
And kind of compare that to the song at the end of the episode. I feel like it's sort of bookending the episode with the two songs. If Felina is the love in the first song and at the end, his love is Baby Blue. So in both cases, you have someone that, or something that you love, and then you're going to get what you deserve in some violent fashion. So perfect song choices on their end, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as the season went on, there was a lot of speculation around the internet that Felina was going to be a woman, a specific woman like Marie or Holly or Skylar. Mm-hmm. But it turned out to be the meth, the chemistry, the job, you know, the stuff that his work, his accomplishment, his status, all that
Although
stuff.
Although you could compare the meth to a person in a way, because at the end when Walt is stroking the vat, it was very similar to the way he was sort of caressing Holly in the bed as if they were both his baby. I thought that was a very interesting connection that the show was making, sort of like he maybe even loved the meth even more than his own child. Or I mean, I guess in a way that's true, because that's where his name is going forward, you know, in the legend. People are going to remember him as the meth kingpin. They yeah. might not remember him as Holly's father.
Yeah.
Probably for the better.
The penultimate shot is of his hand slipping away and leaving that bloody smear on the otherwise pristine vat, which is, A, both his recognition that Jesse is finally as anal retentive at keeping meth cooking equipment as clean as he is, so A, he's trained a good protege, and B, in a very literal sense, he's leaving his mark. Like, that's all he really wanted to do, is leave his mark on the world, and that is literally it. The blood coming out of his body on this piece of laboratory equipment.
And I guess... Oh, go ahead.
Let's say I see at the end that he's recognized, because in the conversation with Skyler, he talks about how he did what he did because he was good at it. And he was the best at cooking meth, and that's why he, you know, did it, and that's why he couldn't stop doing it. And I think at the end, he's kind of realized that, like, him being good at it wasn't reason enough to keep doing it, despite no matter what the consequences. Because he loved the science because it's what he was good at. It gave him power. It gave him control over the world by being good at science. And I think at the end, there's some small recognition on his part that that's not enough. Because of that bloody trail, because of the consequences that it leaves behind.
Can we talk more about that, actually? Because I think that was one of the most important scenes in the episode, or maybe even the show. We've been talking, or John specifically has been talking this season about hell being a job that you can't quit. And I think this episode was a lot about having a job or being competent at something, having the ability to be a craftsman in a way. And Walt really... that's what he wanted. He wanted to be the person who was good at making meth. And I was thinking, actually, I don't know if you've heard of it. It's like the psychological or business oriented thing called self-determination theory. And I looked it up before. It said that people in their jobs and in life want three things, basically. They want autonomy, competency, and relatedness. And that's what Walt has wanted the whole show. He wanted to have control of his life, so autonomy. He wanted to feel, he wanted everyone to know how competent he was, that he was the super genius. And he wanted to be related to the world by providing for his family. And in this last episode, interestingly enough, I thought he was going to die and, you know, suffer throughout, and he was not going to have a happy ending at all. But in this episode, he got all three. He was autonomous. He came up with a plan by himself. He came up with actually two plans, the one with Gretchen and Elliot, and the one at the end with the Nazis, and was very competent with them. And he did have a feeling of relatedness because he was able to give to his son, and he was able to save Jesse. And then at the same time, Jesse was sort of grappling with these issues too, because he had that dream where he was dreaming of him, making that box that he had mentioned back, I forget what season it was, maybe season three. He was talking about how that was the one moment in his life where he felt like useful, where he was in shop class just making a box, and he felt great. At the beginning of the show, Jesse had none of those three things. He had no autonomy because he had to do whatever Walt said. He was completely incompetent, as we remember in that flashback a couple episodes ago when he was like doing that ninja thing in the background. He was just a goof. And he wasn't related to anyone. He was sort of disowned from his family. And now, I guess over the course of the series, very interestingly, Jesse has, it's sort of like this weird twisted Bildungsroman, because Jesse's gone from a kid to like this adult, but in the worst way possible. Like everything has been, is like hellish. I mean, first he didn't have autonomy because he was made into a slave, but he became very competent at making meth. And he was also related in a way to Brock and Andrea, and that was twisted and used against him. But then, and finally, in this final episode, that's his happy ending, is he's free. He has the autonomy to make his own decision not to kill Walt. And he still has that level of competency with meth, and hopefully in the future with making wood stuff, I don't know. And I hope that one day he could find some level of relatedness with someone who's not Walt. But we'll see. We'll see. I was thinking a lot of that. Self-determination theory. What do you guys think?
He had whenever he was on the road to having any kind of relatedness with anyone, and I'm thinking of Kristen Ritter's character, Jane, and also with Andrea, right? Like Walt steps in and messes it up. I don't know. It's morally different. I mean, the result is the same, but it's morally different to watch someone die without intervening. Rather than actively killing them yourself. I mean, right? It was like the drugs and the aspirating vomit what killed her. And he
knocked her over a little bit. You know, he moved the pillow or something.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, so he was a little...
Kept her. Oh, I see. Kept her on her back, kept her from... That's Chekhov spooning, right? Like,
yes.
Don't mention laying on your side.
Connected to all this, I would say that... it's important to note that I think at the end of the day, Walt doesn't, he regrets how it happened, I would think. And he feels sad about the way that things have transpired. But I wouldn't necessarily say he regrets entirely having decided to do this thing. I mean, like, at the end of the day, it seems like he really came to terms with the fact that this is something that he wanted and needed to do, and was very satisfied at the end of his life to reflect on it. And I felt like, but it walks a very fine line, because I think Ben is also right in that he knows that it's not enough, but it's the question of, well, what is enough? What would be enough? And should we expect to have enough? And I think that that's related to one of my favorite, which I really wanted to transcribe this whole, I had this whole plan to transcribe the whole scene, because it's kind of over-talked a little bit. You don't get to hear all of it. But the whole, like, well, if I wanted pizza, I'd go to a pizza place. And if I wanted Thai, I'd go to a Thai place. And why would you even compare them? It's like, are you even the man I married? I'm the man you married, but let me tell you about it. And then it all culminates with that wonderful line of Walt being like, you know, beautiful people, this is where you get to make it right. You know, like, this idea that there are people in the world who get to have enough and who have enough. And those people are Elliot and Gretchen. And Walt is not one of those people. And part of this episode is him coming to terms with that and realizing that, you know, he was not going to have that. I'm, it's almost like it's a really difficult concept to describe. I find words even escaping me. But anyway, jump in.
Well, there's that bit where, I mean, prior to confronting them, he sort of lets them discover him, but he walks around the house and the focus is very much on him, not on Elliot and Gretchen having this conversation off screen, partly to enhance the tension, obviously, but also partly to see Walt reacting to their furniture, their layout, and I very much got the sense that when he's looking around, like, he's checking out his house. He's going through that vision in his head of, if he didn't sell out of gray matter in the early days, or if he didn't walk away, you know, this is what he would have been entitled to. This is what his life could have been. And he's examining it the way a prospective buyer might. And that's even one of the first lines he has to them. I really like your new house. So he's evaluating the life he could have had and saying goodbye to it. And we can even consider those other goodbyes in that same light. He's revisiting the life he could have had with Skylar and Holly and saying goodbye to them. He's revisiting the life he could have had as a meth kingpin with Todd and Lydia and saying goodbye to them.
Yeah. I mean, but do you think if Walt had it all to do again, do you think that he would cook less meth? I almost feel like he would want to cook more meth, that he would want to be more honest about how much he liked cooking meth, you know, that he would tell Skylar about how much he liked cooking meth sooner, that maybe the big hope for his marriage was for his wife to understand how much he liked cooking meth. You know, I mean, that wasn't necessarily going to happen, but...
Can we just dig in a little bit and unpack, like, what is cooking meth... Right, like, of all the assorted kinds of criminality available to a show about Breaking Bad, right? Like, what is cooking meth specifically doing here with respect to the meaning of the show, right? Like, it has to do with science and sort of dominance over nature. It has to do with, like, a very high level of techne, right, that is, you know, like a sort of extreme craftsman, like artisan, like skill level at something. I think it has to do with masculinity somehow. Largely because of the lack of women in STEM fields of study, right? Or at least traditionally, I think that's actually less and less the case.
See, I think part of it is the nature of drug production is that, at least to the amateur, the consequences of it are very distant. And so to a Mr. Chips like Walt, you know, at the beginning of the series, it's something that he thinks he can do while keeping his hands clean. And then the rest of the series is explaining why that's not true.
Well, it's... I see what you're saying, but the consequences to him generally involve his family, generally involve, like, people he knows dying for reasons other than, like, drug addiction, right? And the drug addiction stuff, it comes up, but it's soft pedaled, I think, except in maybe the death of Jane and some of those like hellish, the kind of hellish inferno that Jesse goes through when his parents' house becomes the becomes a meth house, I guess.
Like ATMs on people's heads, probably not a good thing.
Sure.
And even Jane doesn't OD on meth.
Right. But it's but the actual like drug treatment, right? Like, which is, you know, our culture's organized way of dealing with the suffering that drug use wreaks on people's lives, is soft pedaled a little bit and is sort of a figure of fun, the way it is in a lot of TV show where it's like, hi, I'm so and so and I'm an addict. Hi, so and so, where like these kind of rituals and traditions and practices and stuff like this are played for comic effect in a certain, you know, to a certain extent.
There are parts like the family, like the ATM story arc.
Yeah.
And like the story arc with the person shoveling, like there are definitely, they spend a lot more time of it in the earlier seasons. Like season two is really about the havoc that this wreaks in people's lives. Mm-hmm. Right. And also, season two is where we meet the pink teddy bear, of course, which, I've heard described as, the judgment of God. Right, and I think it might have even been Vince Gilligan who described it as such. But this idea that even if the world doesn't necessarily have an overarching, very clear kind of moral superstructure, even if we live in a world of shades of gray, if you do wrong things, there will be reckonings for them. And the eyeball of the teddy bear always watching Walt is the reckoning for all the terrible things he's done that will eventually come around to him. And I thought that that it was interesting in this last episode, we see Holly, and Holly, for the first time in a while, I think, doesn't appear in this episode in her pink bear outfit, right? There was this idea that the judgment against Walt, because Holly has a pink hoodie that is in that looks a lot like the pink bear that fell out of the airplane, which represents that someone else's baby died because of what Walt did, right? And so this whole time, Holly has, these all these seasons, Holly's had this pink outfit, which to me has indicated that she's at risk. Right, that at some point, Walt's actions are going to get Holly killed. And in this episode, you know, he does his little prayer for the keys in the car, and he, you know, he decides to go over, you know, go up out for justice, right? And all of a sudden, this judgment against him kind of falls away, like it's being satisfied, right? Like so.
Yeah.
So,
sorry, go on, Ben.
So, I thought that scene was interesting, and this whole episode, to me, is like the back half of the Samson story.
Yeah.
Where he's being given this kind of gift from this judgment of being given the keys, given the instrumentality to get, you know, as he says, just give me this and I'll do the rest. The rest at this point is not necessarily a good mission, but he's no longer on an evil mission. He's kind of trying to undo all of the evil that he's done. He's willing to bring the entire house down on top of himself to do it.
Yeah. He's the anti-Samson, though, because his hair grows back, and that's what makes him.
Right.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's how Samson
comes from shaving his head. Yeah. That's where he gets his Heisenberg power.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I think that moment where he's in the car and asks, just get me home, I'll do the rest, is the only instance in the entire series that I can recall where he engages in anything like prayer, where he pleads with people at various points, but it's the only time where he sort of offers up to the universe or to God or to the demiurge or whatever, or to Vince Gilligan, that, you know, I have nothing left to offer. Just please make this work for me. Like he's not relying on his own, competency.
I feel like the way this episode was shot too was really underlying sort of the religious element of it. When he's in the car praying to God, it's very claustrophobic. He has ice all around him. It feels like almost he was buried in a way. And then not long after that, when he's back in New Mexico, after he had seen Flynn go into the house, you have that shot through the window that we were talking about before where he's very blurry and it's him just moving down and down. This is right before he goes to see the Nazis. It's like he's already died and he's going down into the underworld to take vengeance on the evil people, and or sort of like an Orphean mission, not that he knows it, to save Jesse, who had been underground and also in a sort of coffin situation in previous episodes. And then at the end of the episode, of course, we have him on the ground, but then the episode sort of expands and pulls back as if we've become God and we're sort of like looking at him below and being like, you did all right, Walt. Good job. I'm the god of the camera.
I think this comes back. A lot of this is all connected, and I do want to talk a little bit about this question of the Western genre and this series. Well, and just genre and the series in general. I mean, my own take on it is I've been like fixating on Westerns ever since. Like I started watching this half season of Breaking Bad, and I've been on Netflix watching anything with a cowboy hat on it, just because I feel like there's so much I don't know about this stuff. Not everything with a cowboy. I haven't done Magic. I think Magic Mike probably has some cowboy hats in it that I haven't seen. But yeah, like Once Upon in the West and like Lonesome Dove I was watching that today.
Magic Mike is actually really similar to Breaking Bad. Sorry to jump in there.
Go on. What's really similar to Breaking Bad?
Magic Mike, not to go off on a tangent, but I think they're really similar, actually.
I'm just going to say, Magic Mike is not what you think it is. Like, Magic Mike is
a good movie. I was shocked.
Magic Mike is
like about capitalism.
It's Steven Soderbergh in the European art film mode, not in the Ocean's 11 mode. You know, it has more in common with like Italian neorealism than it has with, you know, what you might expect with a movie about male strippers. So, you know, I don't know. Give Magic Mike a chance. I'm just saying.
Once okay. You thumbs know. Up to Magic Mike.
I did watch Pitch Perfect finally, and that was excellent. So,
oh, good.
Maybe that one will come up down the pike.
That's also very similar to Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Did you learn the little cup thing?
Make good choices. All right, make good choices. That's the lesson of Breaking Bad. Well, I was thinking this in particular because. So the show ends, and we've all mentioned it. This could have been a lot worse for Walt. This could have been a hard landing, right? It could have been real, real, real bad. Still pretty bad. Could have been like an awful season finale for him, and it wasn't. And a lot of people that I've talked to have been comparing and contrasting different forms of tragedy in the wind up to the end of the show. Like, you know, is this a Greek tragedy? Is this a Shakespearean tragedy? We've talked about it on the podcast. I think John's talked about it as a Greek tragedy, in particular, its Greek tragic elements. But then it's sort of confounding the ending. Because I don't think novels are about long stories where people die penniless but happy for some reason. But yeah, I don't know. But it's like, how does this knowledge of how the story ends change the way that you would contextualize the whole story? Like, where would you locate it among stories, right? Like, we know what Walt wanted now. We know what made him happy. You know, we know what the lesson is as well as we're going to know it. You know, like, well, where does the story land with regards to all of the other stories that are out there?
So you mentioned religion, and I think that this does have a place in the, can't quite think of the right genre, but certainly it does, it is a religious tale, and it's a particularly, I think, Christian ethic of the deathbed confession matters. That in a certain type of morality, if you lead a horrible life and then on your deathbed you have a revelation and confess and repent, it doesn't matter because you did all those horrible things. Whereas in the Christian ethic, that's not necessarily the case. The deathbed confession is important. It doesn't necessarily erase everything you've done, but it does matter. And I think that that's what this final episode is all about, that when the falling's all that's left, the matter that which you fall matters very much.
Yay!
And so for Walt, he is a monster. Like, you're certain he was a monster. But that doesn't mean that in his last, you know, however much time he has to continue being a monster.
You
that,
fool.
That makes sense.
You fool, as if it matters how a man breaks bad.
When the bad is all that's left to break, it matters very much.
Well, yeah. I would add that the guy who wrote the theme song, I remember reading, because the theme song, of course, is what ended the last episode and kicked us into this episode. But the guy who wrote the theme song didn't want to write a song that was about what happened in the events of the show Breaking Bad. And he talked to Vince Gilligan about it. And Vince Gilligan told him, in a general sense, how the show was going to end. And he said, okay, I want to write a theme song about where Walt is at the end of the story. And I want that theme song to play at the beginning of all the episodes. And so the sort of twangy, you know, a sort of empowering kind of badass guitar riff song has kind of been hanging over this whole show like a possibility. as something that could happen, right? That there could be a big showdown in the desert where, you know, the black hats get gunned down and the sheriff gets to ride off into the sunset after a fashion.
And it's also associated with the Western also, I mean, because of the instrumentation and also because certain of the things like the, well, I'm not a guitar player, but like hammer-ons and like bent notes and stuff like that, like place it kind of in the country or blues country guitar sort of heritage. So it's associated with like country music and with kind of Western, you know, with the American frontier, the desert frontier.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that it could be, you could have a show like this where you have a relatively satisfying, relatively positive ending to a really sad story. And it just sort of feels like, okay, we have to do this because the story has to end now. And we'd rather have it have a happy ending than a sad ending and people will feel better about it. But in this case, it does feel like to me a little bit that this ending was earned and telegraphed a little bit. I mean, everything was telegraphed, right? What is it somebody said in our Game of Thrones discussion thread on the website, which is the key is to make lots of predictions. And that way some of them will be true. Which I believe in. And I wrote many, many predictions in that thread. And we've all been predicting. So Breaking Bad has left open a lot of possibilities for how it could end. But now that it has ended this way, the question is, well, how much does Walt's pseudo-redemption at the end of the story, how much does his coming to terms with who he is, what he wanted this whole time, you know, how important is that to the story that came before it? Should we still see it in the same way, or can we? I guess we can't. Yeah.
I think it clearly does matter. It clearly makes a difference in that, you know, Breaking Bad up till this point is a show very much about, you know, plans gone off to glay, or, you know, dealing with the consequences of your actions after you make some bold, dramatic move. It's very much been about that. And this is the only episode where, you know, somebody makes bold plans. They all come off more or less as they're supposed to. The people we expect to die all die at the hands of the people we expect to kill them. And people who we think should get a good ending ride off into the sunset or the sunrise in Jesse's case, and people who we think should die, die. Like, this is the only episode where dramatic justice has been satisfied, and we don't have reason to suspect that it's going to come back to bite us because, obviously, the show's ending. So something has to have happened to change the reality of the show that much for this to work, and Walt's revelation, confession, redemption has to be it, because that's the big change in this episode. That's the one of these things is not like the other when you compare it against every other episode in the arc in the series.
Yeah, I mean, I would totally freaked out. I thought his plan wasn't going to come together. I thought it wasn't going to work because there's totally this scene where he's at a gas station and he's filling up the gas. I noticed this. I'm sure other people noticed this out there too, where Walt was driving a Volvo 240 DL. Now my parents owned a Volvo 740 DL station wagon, which I got to drive when I was in high school. And I'll tell you, the DL stands for diesel fuel, and the 240 DL is a diesel car. And he was filling it with unleaded gas because that gas station.
Pete, that's I hate to well actually you, but I drove a 240 DL when I was in high school, and that is not a diesel car.
Really?
I filled it up with
DL.
I filled it,
okay.
I mean, maybe that's a holdover from the earlier model, and they just kept it for the model name. But I fill that up with 89 octane every time, and that in fact is the car that saved my life in a car crash. So yes, well, that's a sturdy machine that could get you from the icy wastes of New Hampshire to the end of Albuquerque. Because
did you keep the keys in the sun visor?
You know, I should have. I really should have. But in the end, there's no substitute for a displacement, or there's no replacement for displacement, as what's his name says shortly before getting shot.
All right, so the DL must stand for something other than diesel. Ours was diesel, so it must be something else. It must just stand for damn luck or whatever. So, here's a posit. What changed? Here's another thing that changed. And we've remarked on this a couple times. I think it's time to stare this in the face. One of the big changes in this season of the show, and I think one of the huge changes in the whole meth situation at the end of it, there are no Latinos in the show anymore. Not a single one, right? Not a single one. And Felina was a Mexican girl in the song. And the meth trade, the drug trade, and this goes back to what Matt was saying before when you were talking about unpacking what constitutes cooking meth. I think one of the things that Walt really liked was being part of this this power structure and this sort of it's like sort of a non-governmental organizations, right? People who operate outside the law. He liked being part of organized crime, and he liked being part of, and in a Western sense, he was beyond the frontier. He was dealing with people that weren't governed by the laws of the places around him. He was able to operate fluidly as opposed to the very sort of rigid institutional way that he operated in his school. And the fluidity of it allowed him to create realities for other people, which he was really good at doing, which then like prompted them to do things, right? And it's like this story of, you know, he's creating his vision. He's in the empire business, right? And so at the end of the show, at the beginning of the show, we have like the Juarez cartel controls everything. And Gus Fring is a Chilean interloper who's working with the Juarez cartel, and he's very powerful. And then now at the end of the show, Juarez cartel is dead. Gus Fring is dead. All the meth production has been taken over by white supremacists, not just white people, but white supremacists. The last Latino guy was killed and buried in an unmarked grave, right? And at the end, it's, you know, Walt is lying next to the meth thing, like he was the one who did it all along. And I wonder whether one of the things that has changed is the sense that the frontier has closed in this show. Not that it has, you know, like, I mean, one of the ways the show could end is that, oh, we just cut to a bunch of other meth dealers and there's more meth, right? Like, that was one of the reasons why it could never be okay for Walt to just say all these things, is because somebody else would be there and you'd have to deal with them too. I mean, did you guys have any reactions to that? The sort of the way that the socioeconomic and demographic and like the whole cognitive mapping of the whole Southwest seemed to change in this last season. Or is this just you know, ranting? That's just something I'm going off on. Is that
well? I mean, there is, and we talked about this a little. I want to say two episodes ago when Walt runs into the, you know, the First Nations or the Amerindian in the desert, and I commented that's one of the few American Indians we've seen in this entire series, and I hinted at the time of the sense that you know, white people, you know, showed up in Arizona or showed up in New Mexico, you know, 200 years ago. They hung out there for a while, and then eventually they're going to be gone. There's going to be a lot of history and a lot of, you know, probably a lot of natives that are going to be there once they're gone. So, and that came up in the sense of Walt and the legend of Walter White, the legend of Heisenberg in this sense. Like, you know, Walt's a man who's going to walk his time on the earth. His legend's going to rise, and then eventually fade away and get confused, but there'll be a sort of native tradition, a native history that's going to survive long after he's gone, long after people have lost interest in the New Mexico territory. So I say all this, of course, and this episode, the finale, touched on very little of it. In point of fact, it was very much concerned with just the people we've met already. There were no new characters introduced in this episode, aside from the one Nazi who frisks Walt. Other than that, everyone who has speaking lines is someone we've seen before.
I just keep thinking of, I haven't come up with an answer. I was just thinking of power dynamics having to do with, as you were saying, socioeconomic, demographics, race. You know, in earlier seasons when you had those Latino gangs, you got the impression that some of them came from nothing. Like, we went back to, was it Tuco's house in the middle of nowhere in Mexico? It, you know, it's like a one-room shack with an old guy in it. And also with Gus as well, we get the impression that even though he has some sort of family connection or some sort of connection to some government, I don't know, we don't have his background, but he probably didn't come from like super wealth, and maybe I'm wrong about that. But there's sort of like this idea that these people are like trying to build an empire almost from scratch, whereas Walt, as this white guy, sort of feels entitled to it. Like, of course, I was supposed to be the person who had all this money, had all this power in my family life, in my business life, and I don't have it. So he's sort of just bitter about that, and that was an interesting contrast. But then in this final season, he's going up against these Nazis, so that's sort of like a mirror of his own feelings of entitlement based on his race and gender, I guess. And then also he's dealing with this big conglomerate, this Madrigal, that's sort of just, I don't know if they're sort of beyond race in a way, even though they're white and European, but like Lidio Rodarte Quayle, it's like every single name from every single background just mushed together. And she's like robotic. And, you know, we have those people in, was it in Germany, who are so robotic, they're just like putting, I don't know, different condiments on plates. I don't know. So it's like he's being ground up in these like capitalist wheels. I'm trying to figure out like a connection, but like, there's something there that has to do with the way power works and entitlement works and race. I don't know. Someone put it all together for me.
Well, there is something to that. And I don't want to dwell too much on the series overall in this one episode recap, but I suppose we kind of can't help it. So, basically, I mean, it's similar, Shane, it's similar to the argument I made in my post, I think, 2 seasons ago at this point, about Breaking Bad and labor relations in America.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
About the sort of capitalism as a superstructure over the interactions that various people have with each other. Like, you know, you can negotiate with people, you can be an employer or an employee, you can buy and sell, and you can get better or worse terms, but it's all within the superstructure of capitalism. And if you look at capitalism as the house in a casino game, the house always wins.
Yeah.
So that no matter how big Walt gets, he can't become bigger than the conglomerate. He can't become bigger than Madrigal, for instance, or the whole overarching supply and demand network of meth. That even in his absence, there's going to be such a demand for meth that people will find ways to cook it without him. So he wants to get enough power that he's in charge of the system, but there's no level of power that will satisfy that. He can't become bigger than the system. He can't become bigger than the need to supply something that fulfills a demand. And the more he tries, the more he enmeshes himself in that system, because the only means he has to gain power is through his hypercompetency. And his hypercompetency is what the market most wants from him. Like, oh, okay, you're great at cooking meth. Yes, by all means, we'll give you everything you want. Just keep filling this demand for us. Keep cooking meth as long as you possibly can. And then when we're done with you, we'll kick you off to New Hampshire and throw someone else in the basement.
Yeah.
I think it's notable that at one point Walt refers to his cooking as big enough to be listed on the NASDAQ. Right?
Yes.
To be listed on the NASDAQ, which is not, yeah. Madrigal's quite a bit above that. But I wanted to note a good article that I read this week. And I want to also, this is a good opportunity to connect the season finales of Breaking Bad and The Shield a little bit. There's an article by Curtis Mares on the blog Critical Inquiry about racial capitalism in Breaking Bad. And I mean, it's, I think part of the difficulty of this discussion is it feels like it comes with an impetus to indict, right? But like, let's not necessarily indict, right? Because so here's one of the hypotheses, right? One of the hypotheses is that, one of the sort of conjectures or whatever, is that Walt, in shaving his head and wearing a goatee and going out and dealing with the drug dealers, is adopting a sort of cognitive mapping of working class Latinos and operating closer to their economic systems. Like that, so the social interaction that he has with the Latino characters is informed by the way that he attempts to sort of become Latino in certain ways. But he of course never does all the way. Right. But the show provides in its imagery ways of understanding European capitalism, American capitalism, you know, like the sort of Latino dominated Southwestern drug trade. Also, the sort of gray market for labor in the Southwest, which is Latino dominated and all this stuff. And the haircuts are a big part of this and outfits. In this episode, we see two really important things about Walt's outfit. I felt one of them is that he looks like a freaking homeless Vietnam vet, right? And like he has like in all these flash forwards, he looks like a homeless man. And I would argue that, you know, the cognitive mapping of the homeless is significantly subaltern and disenfranchised in the capitalist model, right? Just as a racial cognitive mapping would be, right? Like, you know, if you're interviewing for jobs and you have three candidates who all have the same qualifications and you're in a racial capitalist system, the person with baggy pants, the person with like a sort of a big shaggy jacket, right? And then the person with the suits, like who's going to get the job, right? The person who matches the idea of what they expect you to see. And so I thought it was notable that Walt and Jesse both looked like homeless people in this episode. Like that they looked like, yeah, go ahead, Ben.
Just want to hang one interesting, well, actually on that, because he looks like a homeless person, in every scene, I think, except for one, which is, and I just checked the screenshot, the scene where he's talking to Skyler. He's not wearing the Army Bush jacket anymore. He's actually wearing one of the tan jackets. And I think it's, if not the identical, it's pretty much the same green, lime green shirt he was wearing in the first episode. In that scene alone, I'm sorry if you were getting to that. In that scene alone, instead of looking homeless, like where he just drifts into the background of every shot, in that scene we have not Heisenberg, but Walter White. We have the all the way going back to the pilot. He's trying to recapture that family man personality to the extent that he can.
Yeah, it's really notable that he ends the show in the same outfit that he started the show in, that he goes back, right? And that it may be, oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, right.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally. And that in this case, you know, the differentiation between Walter White and Heisenberg, right? There's a lot of ways of parsing the two of them. But one of them is sort of, you know, how is he functioning with regards to society? And I wanted to connect this with the S.H.I.E.L.D. And I'll try really hard not to spoil anything, right? But because Vic Mackey is the same as Walter White in the respect that he is a white guy with a shaved head, right? And most white guys don't shave their heads because you get a sunburn if you shave your head and you're hanging out all the time. That's why if you're a white guy, you don't say shave your head. But Vic Mackey is a like relatively high-ranking police official, like government official, who shaves his head and also always wears a tight black T-shirt. Right. And he's out among the street gangs, you know, being like, hey, tell me where the kid is. Salvadorans, they're going to get you, like hitting somebody up against a chain link fence. Right. Operating in a similar way outside of his standard role in a racial capitalist society. Right. He's not acting like a white cop. He's acting like a tough guy. Right. And with tough guy being understood as sort of outside of the law, being understood out of sort of polite society, which, while itself not defined by race, has certain really dominant racial characteristics, and this non-sort of polite society has other racial characteristics. And the events of the S.H.I.E.L.D. transpire such that, at the end of the show, Vic Mackey gets put in a very uncomfortable suit, right?
Yes.
He gets a big tie, right? And he gets, like, a big, like, white shirt that, like, can't manage to fit around him, right? And there's this sense that him wearing this outfit is like the ultimate punishment.
Yeah. That's part of, I mean, that's one of the reasons I hold it up as the gold standard of series finales is because, I mean, watching the entirety of The S.H.I.E.L.D., death is too good for Vic Mackey in the final analysis. And like, there is no better torture for him than, it's not really a spoiler, but it's come before, than the job he can't quit.
Yeah.
You know, to reiterate, to bring back a point that's come up.
If Vic Mackey goes to his ex-wife and is like, I did it because I liked it, she'd be like, yes, of course. We all
we knew that all along.
You were never pretending to do this. It's like, I was, because Vic Mackey was also doing a lot of the shady stuff he was doing to get money to pay for medical, for like education for his autistic child. But yeah, like, he never really lorded it over people quite as much as Walter White does. He also was a little bit too flamboyant about how she enjoyed punching people. Really, really believable as a
really.
Yeah. But Matt, how does that connect? Because you said you had a lot of stuff you wanted to talk about, or at least some stuff you wanted to talk about the
imagery. I want to talk about, I mean, so the last thing, and again, this is not a spoiler necessarily for The S.H.I.E.L.D., except in the most like cinematic, except in the sense of like film theory, right? Like the last thing that happens, the last event that happens in The S.H.I.E.L.D. is that he's in his suit, he's working in his cube at his job he can't quit, and there's been not enough motion in the room, and the fluorescent lights over him automatically go off. Yeah. Right? This thing that we're now in the contemporary world, we're all familiar with, like if you work in an office and then you have to like wave your hand a lot so that the motion sensor activates and the fluorescent lights above you go back on again. And so that's, I mean, right, like they're plunging him into darkness. And like, I wanted to compare sort of what happens and like that this is a sort of purgatory for him, right? Like, and it's kind of mostly what you said, Pete. And the last shot of Breaking Bad is a sort of different, it's a sort of different thing, right? The overhead shot that pulls back slowly, like that one actually reminded me of like the last scene of Taxi Driver. I don't know if you remember that, but it's an overhead shot, and it's a moving shot that goes through, that looks down on this Travis Bickle's apartment from overhead. And the effect of it is to transform this location, which I think actually was a real location, into a movie set, right? Like I think it's alienating, right? Like, because it reveals the constructedness of the thing. Alienating, yeah. in the Brechtian sense, because yeah. it's sort of this meth lab, which is a real location, or it's like for the show, it's like a psychologically real location. It really is like him or his personality writ large, kind of projected out into the room. And also, I mean, presumably this is the same equipment from the company that tented houses, right? Because Todd had access to all of that stuff. So it's a lab that he built, you know, himself. It's not Gus Frank's lab. It's his. It's his personality. Like, it sort of reveals the constructedness of that. It reveals it as a TV set, right? Because, you know, where's the ceiling? It's a high warehouse, but it's not that high. We've seen the ceiling before, and we go higher probably than, you know, where the ceiling would be. And it had a distancing effect and was a sort of invitation to contemplate, I think, much more so than the ending of The Shield. The other thing I wanted to talk about with respect to the ending of The Shield is what happens to the number two, right? Because what happens to Shane, and I actually won't spoil that because that is something that you should experience, yeah, because everyone should watch The Shield. But Shane has been the number two, right? Has been the Jesse Pinkman in the sense that he is the sort of less experienced, more impulsive number two, and also in that he kind of plays the body to Vic's mind in the same way that, like, just on the, you know, on the. Oh no! Are you okay, Shane?
Loser,
we're talking. Oh my god! Sorry. Keep talking.
Okay. Shana, it's already over.
Yay!
Just too soon. If you want me to lie down and you could take a camera and just pull back, that'd be good.
I was doing the Saul and water vacuum cleaner story.
They've been using that shot in football games now, when people are injured, and I find it really creepy. Like when the camera's like over their bodies and they're just.
I'm gonna go.
And mute your mic. Your mic.
Well.
I muted her mic. Right, like, I'll unmute her when she comes back. I didn't know I had that power. Look at that. I'm drunk with power. I've got to go shave my head and put on my Heisenberg hat because I can meet any of you whenever I want.
Anyway, and so the other thing that... Actually, mute me. The thing that happens to Jesse, rather than... I mean, but it's safe to say that Shane... Well, his trajectory is different from Jesse's,
yes,
at the end of Breaking Bad, because this is kind of the apotheosis of Jesse, like one in you want that, yes, do it yourself, right? Like, you know, he's not going to work on the farm no more. And the other thing is that, like, he's been associated, I think, with constraints, the constraint of drug addiction, you know, he's been tied up a lot. He scaled a fence to fall into the porta potty to get into the RV thing. He's been imprisoned in the underground bunker. He's been associated with being hemmed in, and like busting through that chain link fence is a significant act. I mean, it's a really sort of kind of weighted act for his character to like bust out of that constraint, to like get through the fence especially in such a kind of dynamic way. And the shot after him of him like delighted and like, you know, screaming with exhilaration from having done this, and I think like moving very fast, you know, because you'll recall like a lot of shots of Jesse where he's like sitting in his house when his house is the drug flop house where there's all this action going around, and he has this kind of like glum, sort of depressive, very static quality among all this exuberant motion, like his own exuberance and his own exhilaration and his own like propulsive motion out at the end of the episode, I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
There's also, I saw an interesting thing online where it was showing like four successive shots of Jesse throughout the seasons where he's in the passenger seat of a car, kind of leaning up against the window, looking out kind of at nothing because he doesn't have agency over the situation. I mean, there's the whole episode where he's riding around with Mike and he literally has no idea where he's going. He just got told, get in the car and we're going to go somewhere. And so him driving now with that expression on his face is kind of a phase shift for him. That now he's in the driver's seat now, that he's kind of in control of his own destiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One more to focus a little more on this episode. And that is, a very good point. There's this recurring visual motif that came up in this episode, and I think touches a little more on the theme of why Walt feels he has to come back, which is machinery that keeps operating even after its operator is done with it. There was one striking image in particular, which is, you know, after the big spectacular Nazi shootout, the massage chair, which keeps going, pumping what's his name's body up and down, sort of like weirdly and like forcing blood further out of him. yes, exactly. And the other example, of course, is long after the Ma 60 in the trunk of his car has depleted its entire belt of ammo, it's still tracking back and forth that vague whirring noise. There's even a point where during the very tense stare down between Jesse and Walt, you hear it just like in the background. And later, after Walt hangs up on Lydia and throws the phone aside and sort of wanders off to the warehouse, you see it still going. And of course, there's the operator's done with it, but the machinery is going to keep going because you've set it in motion. There's no way it's going to stop unless unless someone has the sense or has the reason to come in and turn it off. And this we finally realize is sort of what brings Walter back. He wants to shut down the machinery that he put in motion, 2 years ago at this point. He wants to bring this to a halt.
Either that, or also in another way of looking at it, he feels himself to be an essential part of the eventual machinery, right? Like that on one hand, there is a machinery that continues going in his absence. This, I think, really indicative of this is the prosecutors trying to figure out how to nail Skyler. Like, they have to figure out like how to keep the case going as if Heisenberg were still there. So there's the sort of like perverse way in which the machinery can keep going if Walt isn't there, but there is a way that the machinery keeps going if he is there too. So it's there's an inevitability to his march southwest that is interesting. It's because it's not quite in opposition to the inevitability of things occurring in the southwest in his absence. It's like different inevitabilities kind of shifting back and forth in and out of phase.
To what you said, John, about that's the reason he comes back to the Southwest is to kind of stop this machine. I think that's an answer to a question I've seen in a couple places on various commentary around the internet about like why Lydia? Because Lydia never really did anything to Walt directly. Like, she didn't steal his money. She didn't kill anybody that Walt cared about. And so there were some people who were saying that was just kind of bloody-mindedness on Walt's part, that he poisoned Lydia. But I think it is part and parcel, and it may be that, but I think it's also part and parcel of his idea of wrapping everything up, that she's part of this machine that he's built. And if he doesn't get rid of her, then the rest of this will be for naught because it'll just get built right back up by Lydia and somebody else she finds.
Yeah.
Lydia's the worst. Lydia's I'm glad she died. And Mike said it about her. Mike was the one who really knew how bad Lydia was, right? Not Walt, because Mike knew firsthand about all of her attempts to get everybody killed, right? Trying to murder all of his friends. She tried to murder Walt, right? At least a couple times, or at least like was talking about taking him out.
Well, in this episode.
Yes, I know, in the general scheme of things, murdering Heisenberg is not necessarily the worst thing in the world, but from his own perspective, I would imagine that he would have a vested interest in preventing that from happening. Lydia, I'm glad that there was a reckoning for Lydia. Lydia had her own little purple teddy bear, I'm sure. right? Like her own sort of judgment needed to happen against her in order to for there to be some sort of any sort of justice in the world. I'm not saying she's really the worst because Todd is the worst, but
I could learn a lot from Lydia, Pete.
I could about shoes. Yeah, what could I learn from Lydia, Shannon?
I don't know. I don't know the rest of the song. Something about tattoos.
How to walk in heels in the desert, right? Like, God, it's hard enough doing that in the city, right?
I can't do it. So.
But yeah, I mean, whatever. We don't need to. Yeah, you know, we don't need to diminish the fact that this criminal, this mid-level criminal boss, just because she happens to wear fancy shoes and drink fancy tea, that she isn't, you know, a cold-blooded killer. Grr. All right, we're coming up on an hour, so I mean, we've talked about the big scheme of the show in general. We've talked about its place in relation to some other shows. Is there anything else about this specific episode that we want to get into? Because there's a bunch of other stuff. What about Badger and Skinny Pete? What's up, Ben? Jump in.
Let me pose a question about, because I think there was an overtone in his discussion with the Schwartzes that they owed him. And that's why he was going to them specifically. I mean, obviously the threat is what was going to kind of seal the deal. But I got the sense that he was implying that, even though we don't know the whole history with Gray Matter, that he and they probably recognized that there was some sort of kind of screwing going on. And so now that they owe him this favor. And so maybe Flynn deserves this money from them as his like rightful birthright. So what did you guys make of that interaction?
The whole bit, I love the episode and I thought it was perfect, but right after the episode ended, I was thinking of the Schwartzes and it didn't sit 100% right with me, because I guess it means when Walt beat them, it was sort of like he won the whole game. The whole show was him wanting to sort of... take
so
power
sad.
From them.
He's so sad.
I'm sorry. It's my door. I'm so sad for the Schwartzes. They're my people. They're Jews, right? But they didn't do anything wrong. They shouldn't have had a comeuppance, but they got it. You know, the whole show was Walt caring about their money. He looked at their stock ticker every day. He's always like obsessed with it, and now he sort of scam them in a way that now they have to be obsessed with his money and being like be focused on where it is and where it's going, and they're the ones who have to be looking over their shoulder thinking about Walt for the rest of their lives. It doesn't seem like they deserve it at all.
Yeah, so what exactly did they do wrong, right? Like we get the sense that like Walt was involved with Gretchen, there was a bad breakup or something like that, and like he left and didn't want to be involved in business with an ex. I mean, at least that's the construction I put on it in my head. And so at the time sold his interest in the company for what was then a fair price before it had any of its phenomenal success, right? Like that sucks, but that's not, you know, uncommon.
You're talking like somebody who gets pizza from a pizza place and Thai from a Thai place, Matt.
I can only think of one solution, which is like everyone in this episode sort of got their comeuppance due to a fatal flaw in that tragic way. Like Todd was killed because he was looking out the window because his fatal flaw is he's always impressed by Walt. So he's looking out the window being like, oh, Walt or Mr. White, you did such a good job. And that allowed Jesse to get the drop on him. And Lydia died because she always needs control. She needs to know exactly what she's doing all the time. She's very predictable. Or Jack died because he had that pride, right? He had to show Walt, like, oh, here's Jesse. I'm the one who's in charge, right? So if the Schwartzes have a fatal flaw, and most of the show, I don't think they did. They didn't do anything wrong, as far as I could see. Maybe their fatal flaw was in the last episode, they sort of had, like, this liberal guilt thing going on, where they're like, oh, we have to give to charity, to the people whose lives have been ruined by meth, you know? And they really did it just to make themselves look good and for their business to make more money, or at least that's what Charlie Rose was alluding to. And so in this episode, this final episode, I guess they got their comeuppance because now they have to give to charity, but that charity is Walt Jr. So maybe that's why they needed to get punished in the show's morality, but I don't know. I think that's a stretch.
I think they did do one thing wrong. I don't know that this is that they got just compense for this, but if they had a fatal flaw, it was lying about Walt's role in the company. because that's what set Walt off. Is we don't know exactly what happened, but we're given to understand that Walt was more than just the white in that the white that came up with the name. That we're given to understand that he had a role in creating the science of the company. That he was an intellectual powerhouse that helped form this company. And sure, he may have sold out legally, but he deserves a role in the legacy of the company. Whether or not later on he became a meth dealer or not, he deserves this role. But they're trying to erase that for their own good.
I thought that Schwartz's tragic flaw, to the degree they had a tragic flaw, was their insistence and entitlement to their sense of their own safety.
Right.
Which is that, like, it's okay for us to totally plow under Walt's, you know, legacy as a scientist, as long as it protects our bottom line and our stock price. And so Walt took advantage both of, as you're saying, you know, the sort of a Dantean, you know, a Dantean punishment for their charity, their sort of, you know, their charity, right, that they do to protect themselves, and also how scared they are whenever they might feel that they themselves are threatened, and how quickly they throw everybody else under the bus. And this idea that they're going to be running scared from Badger and Skinny Pete with laser pointers is like, that's the punishment, right? That's the punishment. They don't even know that what they're scared of is nothing, right? And by the way, Saul was right. Laser tag, great investment.
Definitely. I'd like to play devil's advocate really briefly and challenge the notion that that Elliot and Gretchen at all sort of deserve the level of the fate that they've been given. And I compare that to Walt's final conversation with Skyler. I mean, he gives her the location of Hank and Gomez's bodies, and he says, use this as a bargaining chip with DEA, and then he also unburdens his soul to her, which is more than he's done at any point in the show. But I don't think she would, if you asked her, like, do you consider the scales balanced at this point? Like, do you consider this a net-net, you know, equal exchange? She would say, no, what are you kidding? Like, I'm still ultimately the loser here. Like, I had a life with a man I love, and I've lost everything. And, like, this is a minor uptick in the end. It sort of, like, staunches the wound, but doesn't change the fact that I was wounded.
Well, wait, yeah, I mean, what is the wound? I mean, you know, she's lost her house. She's living in much reduced circumstances. She can't do the kind of job that she's trained for. She's what, a taxi dispatcher now?
Yeah.
Which I think is like, I mean, I don't know, is meant to be, you know, not that that's a bad job. Maybe there are some great taxi dispatchers who love that work, but it's meant to be, I think, a sign that it's something that she's not trained for. It's something that's part-time. It's something that's associated with, like, you know, I don't know. I think of the TV show Taxi. I think of, like, I associate it with The Knight.
Yeah, with Danny DeVito and people of his ilk.
Kind of driven...
The horrors
has a very specific place in racial capitalism.
So yeah, I mean, the moral of it could be that, you know, people whose lives happen to cross paths with Walter White often end up getting their lives ruined, and that's just the kind of monster he is. He's doing okay, but he's still pretty poisonous.
Right, for which his self-knowledge, the like newly arrived at self-knowledge and like admission of self-knowledge that he gives to Skyler is a pretty useless palliative, right? For that, for what she's lost, you know?
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, I do get that it's something. It's satisfying for us, the audience, to hear. It's probably not very satisfying for Skyler and her reaction.
Yeah, this is what you get for the, you know, the sexual assault and the years of psychological torture, and then the, you know, getting dragged into a massive criminal conspiracy and, you know, all this. Hey,
and blackmailing your sister, blackmailing the only living family.
To go back to the religious theme,
I liked it. That's what you get.
Was Skyler there when they invented the hippopotamus? Like, why is Skyler entitled to justice, right? Like, why are any of these characters entitled to, like, fairness in a celestial or in, like, a social sense, right? Like, their idea of what they deserve or what they think is fair. I feel like this whole episode operates not on that level, right? Like, and that's the whole point of the Gretchen and Elliot's presence in it, is to make fun of people who think that the universe, you know, owes them comfort or owes them fairness or that they should get what they think they're going to get.
Right. Who have never had that assumption challenged anyway.
I mean, they tore that up. Yeah, exactly. I mean, Ozymandias tore that to shreds, right? It's like right. Everything you work on is going to fall apart. And the question is, okay, if everything that you have is going to be fall apart and all that's going to be left is, you know, the statue in pieces in the desert, then what is it that you can have, right? What is it that you can get in the world if, you know, Ozymandias, the poem, is correct and even the mighty empires are all eventually going to fall, right? And we talked a little bit about this, about how whether Ozymandias is kind of nihilistic or whether it is a kind of romanticizing the role of nature as an equalizer. The idea that in this case, it's, you know, vengeance, justice, these, you know, self-knowledge, truth, you know, these are things you could potentially have for a moment. And that's, I think this comes back to where we started, which is, you know, there are false reveals throughout this entire season up until the very end. But when Walt looks at his reflection in that stainless steel, like, isn't that a true reveal? Isn't the truth of it the thing of it that's really compelling and the reason why it feels like this is an ending? I mean, I think we talk about The Shield having a great season finale, series finale, and it had a very exciting series finale and a very satisfying series finale, but The Shield was a very uneven show that had large, the whole seasons, which just you didn't need to watch and just weren't very good. I mean, they were fine. It was police procedural, you know, like it had like Gangster of the Week episodes and everything. There wasn't really a story that really needed to end in the same way that Breaking Bad has this huge story that needed to end. And an end of the story, like the very end of the story, isn't necessarily always where you punctuate it with like the biggest wow moments. You know, and like that's where they did that in Ozymandias. They don't have to do the crazy revelations in the last episode like they did in The Shield, which are awesome, but which, you know, it has a little more denouement, right? It has a little bit more of that.
I disagree with your assessment of The Shield as not having a story that built to a certain point, but in order to not turn this into about The Shield.
It's a matter of degrees. It definitely did have a story that started at the very beginning that needed to build to a certain point. I just felt like it took breaks from it in the middle, so the tension of it wasn't always present. In the last season, it was definitely present. Let me rephrase it then and say, I felt like the ending of Breaking Bad was more concerned with being an ending than the ending of The Shield was. Because the ending of The Shield also left everything open. And that's not really a spoiler, but it's like more things could happen in the future, maybe. Whereas
I think Walt's a lumberjack at the end of the...
That's like the running gag all over the internet, right?
Oh, is it really? Lumberjack.
Jesus Christ.
Good thing I don't read the internet.
We won't tell you what show that's for, Shana, so you don't consider it a spoiler. It's not for a show we've talked about on the podcast. Yes.
Oh, I lost. Right.
Well, lagging again. The lag finally caught up with it. Okay, we got to bring this. We got to wrap this up. Oh, go ahead.
Compare this. What?
Go ahead. No.
I think we've reintroduced lag. Finally, as a callback to bring the whole podcast in full circle, we've got lag back on the podcast. Don't you bring it home? Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Let's just take a moment. All right, moment over. Final thoughts on Breaking Bad. Let's go around the horn for everybody before we wrap this up. Ben, what are your final thoughts on all of Breaking Bad and everything ever?
So I see the whole kind of arc of Walter White as, like, it goes way down into the depths. And, like, Granite State, Ozymandias was, like, the height of Walt's evilness. Like, this is the worst thing he can do. And then Granite State showed us, like, the punishment for that. That was purgatory, where this is, like, the most punishment that we can dish out. But Vince Gilligan is, like, kind of a nice guy and wants to give us, like, the teeniest tiny little bit of, like, uptick at the end of the story. Like, it doesn't get us back to where we started, but it's this teeniest tiny little bit of redemption, which is why it feels so good. Like, you look at Jesse's situation, like, that was really great that he's, like, off on his own. But he has no money, he has no friends, he has no family, he's presumably a wanted criminal, and he's been, like, tortured for months. So it's not like he's in a great place, but, like, it feels so good because of how far down we've gone.
And his only marketable skill is illegal.
Right. So I think that just shows, like... And so on Breaking Bad as a whole, what I think made Breaking Bad great is how efficient it's been at telling this story. I think a lesser show would have taken, like, 5 episodes to spin this entire last episode, where, like, there'd be a whole episode where it's, like, a procedural of Walt trying to get the ricin into Lydia's tea. And there'd be a whole episode where he's trying to get the M60 into the right place. But Breaking Bad is kind of laser focused, and it brought us this story very efficiently, which I think is what made it so great and so watchable.
Awesome. All right. Shayna, any final thoughts on Breaking Bad and everything else in the universe ever?
Well, if you can't hear me, I'm just going to put this up. Boo lag. I'm just going to leave this here in case you can't hear me.
No, we can.
The end.
Yay!
Yay! Awesome.
Oh, well.
Boo lag.
John!
Up with us.
John, any thoughts on Breaking Bad?
Yes, all right. Here are my thoughts. Moral of the story. If you're really good at something, America is going to find a use for you and is going to reward it. But it's probably going to destroy you in the process if you're not careful. Much more valuable than whatever rewards you can get for that hypercompetency are self-awareness. But if you don't go for that, America will find a use for you anyway. End of moral.
Marvelous. And Matt, any final thoughts?
I agree with John about self-knowledge being the sort of ultimate boon here in this story. I would just add to that getting that great reward of self-knowledge does not prevent awful things from happening to everybody around you. So it's really like, yeah, you get self-knowledge, but your ex-wife is a taxi dispatcher. Way to go.
Well, all I'm going to say is that I don't know how to feel about all this. The whole thing felt shady, morality-wise. But if you'd subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, you click on our site, you visit our website, you comment in the comment thread, you come back and you watch us when we do Game of Thrones, we do Mad Men, you watch our recap of Downton Abbey and their saucy butlers. You do all that.
Which is, by the way, Down Abbey is airing in the UK now. Just saying.
When does it start in the US? You know?
January.
Okay. So we're definitely going to be doing this in January. We're going to keep you posted on other shows. We're going to recap on this channel. But I'll leave it with I'll leave my analysis ending with the finest assassins west of the Mississippi and say that from here, the conversation moves forward on our site. What site is it that you ask that it might be? Why, it is www.overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve.
Wait, don't go off yet.
Okay. Out in the West Texas town of... Oh, here it is.
There we go.
One little kiss and Felina, goodbye.